Today's episode of Hollywood How Did You Get Here is brought to you by G Technologies, a leading storage solution brand for the entertainment industry. Stay tuned for a special offer from G Technology later on in the show. I'd also like to give a special thanks to our lighting sponsor, LEDGO Technologies, for supporting our show. On today's episode, we sit down with time-lapse cinematographer Drew Geraci. Drew's a special kind of cinematographer, a time-lapse cinematographer. Drew was handpicked by David Fincher to create the iconic opening for House of Cards. So we'll talk about that experience as well as what goes into shooting on the top of the Matterhorn and on the streets of Manhattan. Drew's also a self-proclaimed gearhead and Sony ambassador. So let's see what he has to say about the new Sony A7S III. It may just be my next camera, maybe yours too. So settle in as I welcome Drew Geraci to this episode of Hollywood, How Did You Get Here? So Drew, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Tim, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
My pleasure. My pleasure, really. Okay, so let me get this out of the way first. I'm going to fanboy you for a second. Out of all the people that I've interviewed, I don't think you and I have ever actually met face to face.
No, we haven't. We've only had phone conversations and Facebook back and forth.
That's yeah. And I've tried to figure out how to hire you, to get you on a set, anything so I could be like 5 feet away, even on a visit last year to DC. It was like I started texting you because I knew that I was within a couple of miles. So I was just looking forward to that. Anyway, I really don't think there is anyone that does what you do as well as you do it. Nobody.
That's very flattering.
it's really stunning. And then in preparing for this, I really got to, you know, for the interview, watching your stuff again and again.
I'm so sorry.
No, it really confirmed it. I even brought my wife in to say, look at this stuff. And she knows nothing about this stuff, but is blown away by it. For me, probably the first time you came to my attention was House of Cards, and we're going to touch on that a little bit.
Sure.
But since the show is called Hollywood, How Did You Get Here? And in your case, maybe Washington, How Did You Get Here? But let's just say, How did you get here? Tell us a little bit about how you chose, where the love of image making came from. And then maybe a little bit about your military service and possibly why time-lapse? Why did you pick that as a specialty?
That is the biggest, loadedest question ever. It's perfect. I've always had an affinity for wanting to tell stories and capture light and people and just anything in general back when I was in high school. I took a black and white photography class, thought it was incredible to be like, oh, wow, you can actually go into the dark room and adjust the image that you want to. And this is, you know, back in the early or late 90s, early 2000s. So we were still using film at the time. And, just being able to capture those like small moments and then freeze them in time and print them out, I always thought that was really cool. And I kind of wanted to expand upon that. I had gotten a few scholarships to different colleges, but I thought it'd be better to, you know, why not go on an adventure? So I decided to join the Navy. I did that for about 10 years, and I was technically a broadcast journalist in the Navy. So we would go all around the world telling stories, anything and everything. And it really opened my eyes to what's available out there, and being able to see other cultures and being able to see other environments and whatnot. It really helped open my eyes to not just the world of photography, but cinematography and storytelling. And that's kind of what led me to where I am today after I got out was with time-lapse photography.
So let me ask you about the Navy real quick. When you go into the Navy as an image maker, how do you guarantee that you're not peeling potatoes in the mess hall? How do you get that gig specifically?
Well, it's a hard gig to get because honestly, there's very few photographers, cinematographers, or journalists in the Navy. They're now called mass communication specialists. But it's a very small rate. And to get into it, you either have to, A, be lucky enough to have an open billet, which there's usually very few, or you have to strike into it, which means you have to come in as an undesignated sailor. You could be scraping paint, tiling, doing anything else on the ship, and then you have to go into the job, basically, as a photographer, but then you have to get approved for it, and it takes a long time. So I got the job right off the bat when I first joined the Navy. I said that was my only stipulation for joining was I had to be guaranteed the rate. At the time, it was photographer's mate. And it then blossomed into, oh, hey, you want to come join the Navy? We got a spot open for you. And I was like, oh, sure. Why not? Let's go do this. So
how long were you?
It was luck.
How long did you serve?
Just under 10 years.
Holy cow.
Yeah, and that's the point where you have to either figure out if you're going to stay in for another 10 to get your retirement or get the hell out. And if you know me, I'm not a big fan of authority, and I hate being told what to do, and I hate having people above me not knowing their job but telling me to do my job a certain way, and they don't necessarily know what the hell they're talking about. So that's one of the reasons why I got out, and honestly, it was the best decision I've ever made. The Navy made me a stronger person. It made me a better leader, helped with my communication and whatnot. But it was at the end of my tour in the Navy where I started to experiment with time-lapse photography, and really kind of found a love for that, because at the time, no one had been doing HDR time-lapse photography. So I thought, oh, hey, why don't we go out, try to figure this out? Because the process to make HDR images was a pain in the ass. Yeah. I mean, you're talking about, you know, a few hours just for one single frame. And I wanted to do, you know, 400 to 500 single frames. So, you know, one process shot of HDR probably took about 2 days to actually compile and render, which was insane. So,
also, are they sending you out on assignments where they're looking for art, or they're looking for, I mean, it's not like they hired you to make art in the Navy. I mean, it was.
No, not at all.
How many sunsets can you have over the Atlantic or sunrises?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, the main mission of as a photographer or as a mass communication or combat photographer is to tell the story of the mission.
Right.
And that mission could be air ops, that could be on the ground with deployed troops, or back at home showcasing what's happening behind the scenes at, you know, armories and whatnot. But there's all these different things, and they have to be archived and they have to be documented. And that's what we were basically there to do. We really weren't there to create pretty pictures, but we could be creative with how we shot and documented, which is where I kind of wanted to like step aside and be like, oh, hey, you know what? Maybe I'll put a little twist on this and drag the shutter and make it look different than normal. Or just try to find avenues to be creative in a very uncreative space.
All right, so let's jump out of the military into the real world for a second. Why? How'd you settle on time lapse? Not that you've settled on it. I know you do other work than that, but I mean, it's not like you. There's no class on time lapse in college or even in the Navy. I mean, how did you perfect this or this form, this art form?
Well, you know, the perfection came from, let's just say, some negative motivation from another photographer. A very influential Sports Illustrated photographer basically told me that I sucked at what I did, and it was specifically with time lapse. And I got the notion of, well, if he says I suck this bad, then I should probably stop. But then I was like, no, I'm going to figure out how to do it better and be the best at it. So I kind of took that motivation to then say, okay, how do I make this better? How do I step up my game? How do I make it look more cinematic, more Hollywood? And over the course of about a year or two, I had gained enough recognition, followers, and accolades from other directors and editors out there. They're like, oh, wow, this guy knows what the hell he's talking about and how to do it. And it's funny enough, the person that had basically motivated me to get into time-lapse photography asked me for my opinion on how to do something and what he could do to create motion control. And I was just like, you know what? No, I'm good. And I told him to basically piss off. But it's really, time-lapse has really opened my eyes. There's a lot that you can do with time-lapse. It's not just your standard cinematography. You're seeing an evolution of time elapse right in front of your eyes. And it's something that's really unique. And I think it's captivating. And I think it's something that draws the audience in. And it's not just used, let's just say, for intros and whatnot, but it's great for, you know, transitions from one time to another time, or either just to break up the monotony in a piece. So I think there's a lot of different avenues that it can be used in, for both commercial, feature, and like television shows. So
sure beats the old like montage that went on for 5 minutes to get through the passing of time, and all of a sudden you've got, you know, people changing their clothes and just whatever it made to feel like days had gone. How do you visualize it? How do you like if you're on a set in a traditional narrative, you visualize the lighting, you visualize the performance, you see the room, you see the stage, but time lapse you. I don't know. Is it like being a chef? You just understand that if you put a little more of this or a little more of that, it's going to taste different? Is it a acquired thing?
It is an acquired thing. I mean, it's something that obviously you can't control the situation that you're in. Everything is uncontrolled to a point, and you really have to rely on either scouting the day before or months before or whatnot, but just being able to have the eye to say, okay, I know this is going to happen here. I know this is going to happen there, and then anticipate that. And then plan for that and hope for the best, because you never know when a rogue cloud's going to come in and block the sun and you have no light and you're hoping to get shadow shots, or birds fly in, or a big giant dump truck comes in and parks right in front of your camera. All these things happen, even on set. We've had so many different just mess ups. So you're just like, oh, well, thanks.
And then you got to start over, right? I mean,
yeah, you have to start all over. That's the thing that sucks. You know, we were talking, I just had a meeting with a director, and it's really great. And we're talking about, well, what happens if so-and-so walks in front of the camera, or one of the, you know, people nudge the dolly. I'm like, oh, well, we have to start all over again. And he's like, what? There's no stopping and starting, like, especially in a motion control move. If you break even one frame, you're going to destroy that motion and you're going to have to start all over again. So it's pretty much a crapshoot. And that's why normally, or when I started doing this, I don't use one camera. I use six to capture the same shot. That's way there's a backup to the backup to the backup to the backup to ensure that the shot gets, you know, what it needs to be.
You duplicate, but are you different angles? Not that you're just not like layering six cameras for the same shot, right?
No, exactly. Different angles.
So you have something to cut to.
Exactly.
Got it.
And that's really what I learned from shooting with House of Cards and working with Fincher, was just the fact that creating sequences is possible inside of, you know, time-lapse photography as well. So,
all right, let's jump to House of Cards.
Yeah, let's do it.
So, I mean, that was, I loved the show, but I loved the opening more. you know, visually, you know, it's, so it was primarily a Red show, and it was the early days of Red.
Sure.
And yeah, and it was a learning curve with Red, and I didn't think the look was spectacular until later in the seasons in, as everybody sort of mastered the art of the Red. And now I think the Red is a spectacular camera, does great work. Everybody's kind of got it dialed in now, but in the early days of Red, it was a little bit more challenging. Like, and I've been involved in introductions of new cameras. There's a learning curve, no question.
Yeah, sure.
But in the case of House of Cards, the opening was so dramatically different than the shoot. It had that whole great look to it. And that's where I sort of noticed your work. That's probably where a lot of people noticed your work. Am I right on that?
It tends to be one of those things like, oh, hey, you did House of Cards. Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, that's pretty much the jumping off point. But, I mean, I had done prior to House of Cards, I'd worked with the NFL and Discovery Channel and some other folks. So I think the catalyst was House of Cards and being able to propel me deeper into the Hollywood feature set, everything.
Yeah,
so
that's something about the show as opposed to the live stuff or even the commercial stuff. But, you know, I'd done been involved in a couple of time-lapse things. We originally on Saturday Night Live in the opening sequence of that and mounting things on cards and, you know, and they had Alex Bono was the DP on it. It was spectacular. A little bit different than what you do, but it kind of had that effect. I personally had one experience trying to shoot time lapse that was a that was bizarrely a failure for a show. I think it was called Mayans AC Motorcycle Gang kind of show, right?
Okay.
And the director, who I knew, asked me to bring in this camera that Canon made called an ME20, which was a 4 million ISO camera, unique piece, and just to do a moon rising shot out in some field where the motorcycle gang was. And I was set up, tripod was up, we're out in the woods, out in the bushes kind of thing, and I'm just shooting, and it's going to take 45 minutes maybe to shoot this one shot that's going to be sped up.
It's pretty fast.
Yeah, it was moving quick, and it wasn't really going to be a big shot. It was probably only going to be 6 seconds of the show kind of thing. It was just to get it with available lighting and see what he could get when a snake bit my foot.
What?
In the middle of it. Just you know, they gave us the whole snake wrangler thing, and there was a woman out there with a pair of claws, and she was supposed to be paying attention. And then I'm just starting to pan up a little bit, trying to move the camera up and down only just to try to follow it is what he asked me to do. And right into my sneaker is right into the rubber of the shoe. Didn't get into the skin.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, till it wrapped itself up on my leg because it couldn't get its fangs out of the rubber. And in the middle of the whole shot, she's like trying to take this snake from her, unwind it from around my calf and
you're still shooting?
I didn't turn it off, but I'm not paying a whole lot of attention to it.
I wouldn't be paying attention. Freaking snake just bit you. What the hell?
Yeah. The audio was fantastic, actually. So they, I don't think they ended up using any of it, but I'm pleading that wasn't my issue. We had snake wranglers. Sure. So you're right. Anything obviously can happen. And from that point on, I thought, you know, you hire people that know what they're doing and just go with that.
Yeah.
All right. So back to House of Cards. A lot of questions. Number one was.
Let's answer them.
Who gave David Fincher your phone number? How did that happen?
That's the craziest thing is David Fincher gave David Fincher my number. So he told me the story of how he was watching my work that I had produced in bed as he's like going through his nightly routine. He's like, ah, Drew, I love the shot you did with this, this, and this, and that, that, and that. And here I'm sitting myself, and I was like 25 at the time. I'm like, wow, here's, you know, A-list director talking about my work as he's watching it in bed on a Vimeo channel. And I was just dumbfounded. Like, I thought it was so cool to see the power of just putting your work out there and seeing who sees it. And honestly, it's not about the number of viewers that sees it, but it's just about the right viewers seeing it. And I guess it just came in at the perfect time because I had put together a DC time lapse, which, let's be honest, it wasn't that great. But I think, you know, Fincher looked at it, saw potential, and, you know, called me up for a date for lunch. And we were just like, hey, what can you do with this, this, and this? And I was like, oh, I think we could probably make something out of it. So it was a really cool experience.
Yeah, I met him one time on one film.
Yeah.
Years ago, I worked on a film with Soderbergh, and Fincher plays Fincher in the movie. Because there's a movie inside the movie of the storyline, so a movie inside the movie, and he's the director of the movie in the movie. I guess when you're Soderbergh, you get Fincher to play Fincher.
Super meta.
Yeah, and, well, and the movie wasn't great. But I couldn't even talk to him. Just, you know, it was like, oh my God, isn't that, I mean, I didn't know who he, I mean, I knew who he was. I didn't, when he was still sitting there behind a camera playing the part of the director, I just thought it was some guy playing David Fincher, you know, it's like, who is this? It was, I mean, it was a bizarre film with Julia Roberts and Brad Pitt and a lot of great stars. So you never knew who was going to show up, but David Fincher played David Fincher, but nice guy. Seemed like a nice guy, but honestly, I couldn't even have a conversation with him. I just was like, just did my thing on the kit with the camera crew. So
I really enjoyed working with him. He was a very interesting director to work with. And I've heard like both sides of the coin working with him. Yeah. So I guess it just depends on where you're at. But I mean, I've had a really great experience. And his only direction towards me was just go out and find something that's dark, gritty, and like dirty DC. And I was like, yeah, no problem. That's pretty much all of DC.
How long did the shoot take? Let's say House of Cards in particular. You had to give that one your all, I'm sure.
Yeah, we gave it our all. So that's actually shot over a course of 6 months. And
wow.
When we first started talking, it was back in either February or March of 2011, I think. The 5D Mark II had just come out, at that point. We were talking – oh, no, sorry. The 5D Mark III was about to come out, and we wanted to use the 5D Mark III, but we couldn't. And we were sitting there chatting, and he's like, oh, I want all snow shots. I want this to be cold and dark and dreary. And I'm like, well, it's March, and we're about to be going into spring. I'm like, we're not going to get any freaking snow here. So we ended up shooting the next 6 months of as much dark and stormy stuff as we could with shadows sweeping over the buildings. I always thought that was a beautiful aspect of the shot, kind of like the darkness taking over DC. And we kept going for it, and it wasn't until season two where they came back and said, hey, Drew, we need you to go replace all of these shots with snow scenes because we do want to have it to be colder and more dreary and darker. And I was like, okay, no problem. So we went back and reshot everything. Basically, if you look between season one and season two, there's a total of 13 or 14 revised shots that all have snow in them now. So, and that's what they use for the rest of the seasons.
So you live in DC area, right?
Yeah, I live in outside Alexandria, Virginia.
Yeah. So, yeah. And you spend a lot of time shooting in D.C. for a million different reasons, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
You ever run into anybody who's brought up the House of Cards thing to you and said, you know, have you ever seen it? Or have they ever mentioned, I mean.
Yeah, that's a great question. And when House of Cards first came out, it was kind of really surreal how it happened. So I was actually up at the Capitol shooting some time lapses just for myself. And a guy on a bicycle came by and asked me what I was doing. And I was like, oh, I'm just shooting some time lapses. He's like, oh, like the House of Cards sequence. Have you seen that? And I'm like, funny enough, I have seen it. And I introduced myself. I was like, oh, I actually shot that. And the guy freaks out. He's like, no way. He's like, I don't believe you. And I was just like, yeah, that's what I worked. And he's like, wow. He's like, good job. Keep it going. And there was another instance where I was set up on a bridge shooting, and a guy came up to me. He's like, oh, what are you doing over here? And I was like, oh, again, just shooting some time lapse. He's like, oh, wow. So that movie or that television show House of Cards, they captured my house in it. I thought that was so cool. And I was like, oh, well, where's your house at? And he was like, oh, it's off of D Street, blah, 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 blah. I was like, oh, yeah, I remember shooting that. And he's like, what do you mean you remember shooting that? And I was like, oh, well, I made the intro to that. And he's like, oh, wow. And it was really cool. So it does happen quite often that people come up and, you know, relate or talk about House of Cards.
You know how unique that is, though, for people to remember an sure. intro? I mean, yeah. If you talk about television, people remember the intro to House of Cards. And then all the Brady Bunch kids in the square. You know, right, I mean, exactly. There's only a couple of iconic intros, and that's one of them. Yeah. And that was the way your career kind of started almost. So
where's yeah, it is. It's where it started and definitely where it took off. And kind of funny enough, and I'll kind of segue this, I don't know if you want to, into the Corona commercial that I started producing. But that was probably one of the hardest, most challenging experiences for me when it came to time lapse. But there was a funny moment in there where we're sitting down to dinner after the shoot, and the guy's talking. He's like, wow, you really gave those House of Cards guys a run for their money on these time lapses. And I basically turned around because we didn't discuss anything before. I was like, well, we created the House of Cards intro. And he's like, what? We got the House of Cards guys to do this? And it was pretty fun.
All right, so let's talk about the Corona shot. So because this is 2020, first of all, we wanted to define what we mean by the Corona shot.
Exactly.
And I assume they were your client. It was Corona Beer. And you staged this spectacular shot where the moon, which is in a crescent shape, kind of looking like a lime, ends up landing in the top of a bottle of a billboard in a city I don't recognize, I don't think. I don't remember where it was. But tell me about that, how that went.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's in the middle of Manhattan. Yeah, it was down in Chelsea. And the object was to basically have the moon drop into the bottle as if it was a wedge of lime. And it had to be so precise that we couldn't be off more than a few millimeters. So hired a bunch of mathematicians to come out. We marked some locations on the sidewalk and on the pavement and basically had to figure out, you know, the height of the camera, the sensor, the lens, everything, to get it to where the moon would actually fall into the position that we thought it would fall into. And after we had 5 attempts to do it, and on our first attempt, we got it. We nailed it. And there was such a sigh of relief because honestly, I was like, wow, if we miss this shot, it's going to really suck, because that's the whole point of this campaign, is to go out and shoot it. And prior to that, to even get on board for it, I had to kind of create a mock billboard with the moon falling into it, showing that it's possible to shoot it. So we presented that to the client, and they were like, oh, wow, that looks great. I think if we can figure out the actual position, then that'll be perfect. And just logistics, getting everything together. It was a 3 or 4 day shoot, and we had obviously the 5 opportunities to get it. But we just nailed it the first night and then kept nailing it every other night. And it was awesome.
Yeah, but your prep was months, right? I mean, that wasn't something you put together in 30 days.
No. Well, it was about a 2-month prep time, which was pretty fast, actually, to put everything together. So it was cool. And we ended up winning 3 Golden Lions at the Cannes Film Festival, which is fantastic.
Wow. I forgot you get awards for that kind of stuff, too.
Yeah, I know, right? Yeah.
So Cannes is one of the places you've been, I assume.
I haven't. I've wanted to go.
You didn't even go to pick up an award?
No. And you know how much those awards cost when you have to get them? They're like $1,500 a pop, which is ridiculous.
But to actually buy the statue?
Yeah, to buy the statue that you that you win, which is great.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, see what I learned. All right. So while we're also talking about bizarre places in your shoots, the Matterhorn shoot. Okay, Now that one I have not actually seen in the wild. I've seen it on your site. And before we're done here, we want to shout out to the site so people can go back and watch what we've been talking about. But who was the Matterhorn shoot for, and what are the logistics of that? It seemed, I don't know, it seemed like an impossible task to me.
Yeah, well, I mean, when we first got tasked with it, it seemed very challenging. This was going to be for Red Bull Media, and they were producing it for the show on Netflix called The Horn. Which is a really great show. It's about helicopter rescue pilots that go out and pick people up off the sides of mountains, inside the crevasses. Really incredible work that they're doing. So our job was there we were tasked with creating beautiful scenics. So we were the second unit. We were out there to get shots of the Matterhorn, of the air rescue, the city, and everything in between. And when I first got there, the biggest challenge for us is that when you get to Zermatt, there's absolutely no vehicles. So everything is in walking distance. And we roll in with, you know, 500 or 600 pounds of gear, and only a 3-man group. We're just like, wow, okay, this is going to be a challenging job. So we had to find a hotel that was basically between every single shoot that we were doing, had to plan out logistically how to get gear from one location to the next location. And then we had to figure out how to get that gear on top of the mountain. And that in itself took a tremendous effort. We actually had to get a train. We had to bring, you know, almost 500 pounds worth of gear up to the observatory that they have up there, the Gonograd Observatory. And then we were out at night at about 2 a.m. setting up all of our cameras in negative 22 degree weather. And it was just bone chilling. But it was probably the most magical thing I've ever seen, because to see the snow just glistening in the sky as it's just like, it's almost just hovering there. It's not even falling. It's just like staying there. So you get these really beautiful crystal patterns. But the air was so crisp and so clean to be able to capture the Milky Way and the stars at night. It was just incredible. The downside to all of that, with all of the cold that's happening, is I actually developed pneumonia while I was up there. And for 4 or 5 days, I was like, man, it's so hard to breathe. Like, I don't know what's going on. I was like, okay, just altitude sickness. That's fine. I'll take a rest. And as it kept going on and on, by about day 14 out of the 25 or so that we were there, I basically collapsed on the runway of where the helicopter pad was, where we were actually shooting for that day. And thankfully enough, the guys that we were filming rescue other people came and rescued me, and took me to the hospital, got diagnosed with pneumonia, and basically I was in bed rest for 2 or 3 days after that, just getting back to normal.
Yeah, that's the part where I said it looked impossible. I didn't realize how right I was. I mean, it seemed incredibly dangerous. It seemed incredibly time-consuming. It seemed ridiculously cold. It seemed like everything I would not want to do. Although the images are spectacular. So
yeah, I was so blown away by just the mountain itself and being able to capture that, especially with the sun, you know, rising up on it and giving it that nice, beautiful alpenglow. It's something you can't see really anywhere else in the world. And to be up in the Swiss Alps was pretty incredible.
So was that the most dangerous one you've gone out on, or no?
You know what? Someone asked me this question before. I think it's probably just because of the pneumonia, the most dangerous. But, you know, Buddy and I were working on a shoot down in Arizona, and we were walking aside along some of the cliffs down in I'll tell you what, this is a better story. So we were filming for REI in Arizona down to Grand Canyon, and it was about 2 o'clock in the morning. We had to position ourselves above the Colorado River so we could watch these rafters as they're coming down. But that river drive took about 2.5 hours to get through Indian Reservation territory, and it had been raining the day before. And we get to this really like dark area of the desert, and all of a sudden, the tires just stopped moving. We're like, what the hell's going on? And it turns out that we had got into a riverbed that just had water in it, and our tires were basically stuck in there. And the rain started pouring down. It was getting crazy out. The potential for a flash flood was imminent, and it was coming. And we basically had to push our 4Runner out of the dirt with all hands on deck, and barely made it out before the car was going to get like swept away. And it was probably the most intense thing I've ever been in. And needless to say, it could have gone 100 different ways wrong. So it was. I'm glad that we got out of there alive.
Got the shot.
Yeah, we did. Actually, we did get the shot. It was pretty cool.
All right. So tell me a little bit about District 7.
Yeah. So, I mean, District 7, we specialize as a second unit for TV and film and everything from motion control time lapse to aerial photography to high speed cinematography. And anything and everything in between. And we also do full live productions, utilizing, you know, any camera that you want. So
how big's the crew? Do you scale up, scale down? I mean,
we scale up and scale down. I mean, I had 4 full-time members before COVID. Now it's just myself. And prior to that, I've got about 27 different contractors, from editors, producers, to DPs and camera operators, ACs, everything that we use for our normal productions. So a normal team size for us is anywhere between, you know, 6 to 12 people. And that's going out capturing, producing, as well as editing as well.
So is there this is going to be my ignorance here, but how much of what District 7 is doing is stock footage versus a client, or do you do both, or?
Well, I mean, as far as revenue goes, stock footage is a pretty big part of what we do. It probably accounts for about 40% of our overall income for the year. But the majority of our work does come from doing full start to finish productions across the board.
All right. So one last question before we move on to the gear side of the show. How much camera gear do you take on vacation with you?
Too much camera gear. I'll tell you what, man. My wife hates it because we went to Australia and it was supposed to be a quote unquote vacation. And, you know, I ended up bringing out my motion control sliders, 3 or 4 different cameras. Oh, and yeah, it just turned into a big production. And she didn't appreciate that too much. So,
But you can't help yourself.
I can't help it. When you go to these beautiful locations, you want to capture them. And I mean, that's what I want to do, even on my off days, is just go out and capture beautiful things. And, I mean, I think the upside is that there's a market for it, but at the same time, you know,
it's a vacation.
It's a vacation. Yeah.
Wow. Sliders. Yeah. I thought you were going to say, well, you know, I always pick 2 or 3 lenses and a couple of bodies. Oh, and now I bring my sliders.
I go big. So, I'm going to bring it out with me.
So if your room's got a balcony, that's where everything is, just all day long shooting whatever you can get.
Yeah, exactly.
So you'll like walk the hotel first and decide what part of the hotel you want to be on. So you know where the sunrise is or the sunset is.
Oh, we don't even go to the hotel, man. I'll get up at like 3 o'clock in the morning to drive out and set up and do everything. So hotel is just a place to rest your head for the day and then go back out and hit it hard.
You're a barrel of laughs on vacation.
Yeah, super fun. A lot of people love it.
So gear, before we jump over to gear, just back to District 7 a second.
Sure.
You know, I'm going to combine this gear. I got to think that District 7 has about as much gear as a Hollywood rental house.
We have quite a bit of gear.
And everything you seem to have is whatever came out last. I don't know is it because you're a gearhead or because you like the toys, or is everything changing so fast that you really just have to stay up with it? You can't just pick out a camera that you bought 4 years ago and use it like everybody else does?
I think the answer to that question is all of the above. I mean, you have to stay current in this marketplace. People and companies and production companies, they look at what you have, what you're doing, and if they see that you're not evolving with the technology and with the gear, then they're probably less likely to pick you. I mean, you can stick with the camera. I mean, hell, you could be with like a red Epic Dragon or something, but you really honestly probably wouldn't be as competitive to someone who has a Helium or a Monstro, because people go after those big words like 8K and 5K and HDR, and if your equipment doesn't have that, then you're pretty much being left behind in the dust.
Cool.
But for me personally, they're all just tools. And I want to make sure I have the tools that are best suited for the jobs that I do. And every so often, you know, they come out with new cameras or new gear that really just take the production level to a whole nother level. And that's really what I want to be concerned with. And I have a fair cycle with all my equipment. You know, I'll keep it for probably 2 or 3 years, sell it off, and then just bring in new gear. And I'm constantly doing that. Just because I don't want to be inundated with old equipment. I want to have the newest, I want to have the latest, except when it comes to lenses. I mean, I love cinema lenses. I've, you know, bought a full set of the Takina Primes, the Vistas, love those. And really getting back into all of Sony's lenses as well, using those as well. And would love to have a pair of the Atlas Anamorphics at some point too, because those are beautiful. We shot project on those recently for Showtime, and I was just blown away by the beauty of those lenses. But without getting too much into the gear,
well, we're going into the gear section. So this is probably a perfect segue. So we're going to take a break, let one of our sponsors do their commercial thing, pay the bills, then we're going to come back with Tools of the Craft. So hang in there for just a second and we'll be right back. This week's episode of Hollywood How Did You Get Here is brought to you by G Technology. Since their inception in 2004, G Technology has offered affordable, reliable, high-performance hard drives. This week, in collaboration with G Technology, we're offering listeners of this podcast 10% off G Technology drives when you shop at filmtools.com. All you have to do is enter code HOLLYWOOD when you purchase a G Technology drive on filmtools.com. That's HOLLYWOOD to get 10% off G Technology drives from Film Tools. So if you're in the market for some new storage, make sure to head over to Film Tools and use code HOLLYWOOD at checkout to get 10% off your next G Technology drive purchase. And now back to the show. All right, we are back, and this is our section called Tools of the Craft, and the guy owns one of everything, probably two. But I have a couple of questions when it comes to gear. There are currently more cameras on the market than you can even name, and they're coming out at a fast and furious rate. So
they are.
And I know you're an ambassador to Sony. I think that's the title.
Yeah, I'm a Sony Artisan of Imagery.
Okay, so and we love that stuff, but I have a camera background as well, and so here's my question, and I used to ask this a lot. When it comes to cameras, what are you looking for? Resolution, bit depth, or dynamic range? If you had to get one, put it in one, two, and three.
One, two, and three. The first would be, dynamic range. You really want to be able to have the ability to pull out those shadows, highlights, and midtones and post. And if the camera you're using doesn't have good dynamic range, then you're pretty much setting yourself up for failure. Next would definitely be, resolution, because there's so much you can do with resolution, especially when all the markets are coming out with 4K, even 8K televisions now. So being able to have higher resolutions and then down sampling it to like a 4K or 1080p, it's pretty huge. And then bit depth obviously comes in, I would say, at a number one or number two spot too, just because the more bit depth you have, the better the color looks and the more rich in tones you can do when you're in the color grading process. So I think all three of those as a combination are really the most important when picking a camera. And there's a ton of cameras on the market right now that, fit the bill for all of those.
It's not really a fair question. I ask it all the time, but I understand it's like asking an artist, asking a painter what's the best color. It's what's appropriate. But as manufacturers, they tend to chase one, two, or three of those in a certain order, probably for marketing purposes more than anything else. It's just something that's easy. Ks are easy to understand and communicate. Dynamic range a little bit because you can give it a stop number because you can quantify it with numbers. And I don't think most people understand bit depth, to be honest. So in terms of what it does to your what it does to your image, 444, 420, 816, it just
all the good stuff.
All the good stuff, and they just don't kind of grasp that.
No.
It's not on there.
Sure.
So when I first became aware of you, you were a Canon shooter, now you're a Sony shooter. Is it the mirrorless thing? I mean, there was a huge move to mirrorless. Canon was a little late coming to that party. But in time lapse, does mirrorless play a big thing in this, or?
Well, it's hard to say. So my biggest jump, or my jump from Canon to Sony, was purely based on the image quality.
Mm-hmm.
I think when the A7S first came out, which was my first Sony camera, I had been using the 5D Mark III. But checking out the dynamic range between those two was just night and day.
Yeah.
I mean, I could pull a good 2 to 3 stops out of the Sony over the Canon. And especially for time-lapse photography, when you're talking about doing day-to-night transitions, or you want to pull those shadows out of a very stark, contrasted scene, you couldn't do that with the Canon at the time.
When you're doing day-to-night, can you ride the exposure, or do you cannot touch it?
You can. And I mean, that's the next reason why I switched to specifically Sony, was based on their metering system for the light. If you threw it into aperture priority mode, you could evenly get a ramp from, -3 exposure all the way up to +3 exposure, mm-hmm. as you're transitioning from day into night. So you get that beautiful ramp of the sun coming up and catching the glow, but it's not overexposed or underexposed. And that's something that, I'd wanted to do with Canon for a long time, but their technology just wasn't there. And it would produce a ton of flicker, or you had to do a manual stop down method, and there was the potential to ruin the shot there. And for me, it was just a no-brainer switching to Sony and being able to utilize all of these different tools. And it just so happened to be that was their first mirrorless camera. Personally, when I first got the mirrorless camera, I was like, oh wow, this thing is so small and dainty, I'm gonna break it.
Yeah.
And I had wished for like a more rugged body, like the 5D Mark III at the time. And it wasn't until I started traveling with them more that I loved the mirrorless design. Being able to fit, 4 or 5 bodies in one case versus like 2 or 3 of like larger DSLRs, it was just a game changer for me, because I could bring more lenses, bring more equipment, and it was lighter, of course, if we were out hiking and bringing gear around. So it was a big change for me. And honestly, I haven't looked back and said, oh, wow, I wish I had a DSLR now, because honestly, and not to, boast about Sony, like they've really come a long way and really refined their mirrorless cameras to the point now where I really like something would have to be 10,000 times better to switch.
Yeah. So. It's like I lived through that,
sure.
My career kind of started with SLRs with the Canon SLRs. And yeah. everything you say is true. It's accurate. It's something about Canon was probably, Canon was first to the market. That's probably why
Absolutely.
You, and it can be a challenge to be first after a few years.
Yeah.
You develop, you put it out, and then it is a little easier to be second to the market because you've got a reference point. Sure. And then you have a company like Sony, which has huge resources and great engineers and all that kind of stuff. So, believe me, they felt the pinch of the mirrorless. A lot of people jumped to mirrorless because of size. I was just curious to see how it played into time lapse, and it not really that's not the answer I expected, which was kind of cool.
Yeah.
Mirrorless made a big thing. I mean, I think the future is for everybody has to be mirrorless. You're not going anywhere.
Yeah.
What are you using for conventionals? Are you shooting Reds and things too?
Yeah. So, I mean, I was a Red owner for a while. I got myself out of Red because I see Red as kind of like a money pit right now. The technology that they're creating is great, and I love the quality and the look of it. But you can pretty much achieve the exact same quality of work with cameras that are 1/4 the cost. And I think Red recognizes that as well. You can just tell by the prices of everything, how they're dropping and dwindling. I mean, you could buy a Helium 8K camera. When I bought it, it was like $35,000. Now they're under $20,000.
Yeah.
So the prices are dropping significantly. Because they know the market share is, shifting. And I think that's why they came out with the new Komodo, which seems like a pretty interesting camera, but it also seems like they're trying to market to Canon just because it's using almost all Canon proprietary, cards and batteries and whatnot. So I think there's that. But I do use traditional cameras. I've owned a Sony FX9 as well as a Venice that we have on rent. And I use the Alexa Mini and LF for projects as well. So really all over the place.
So we talked about dynamic range and resolution. What about sensor size? How does that play into your future?
Well, sensor size is huge. So we just did something for someone that I can't say, but it's a awesome director. I'm 100% sure you've seen his movies. But sensor size was important, and we had to shoot at a resolution of 10K. And above for these shots. And we were using the A7 R4, which had just came out, and it was pretty much filling a spot that was going to be either medium format or this. And this just had the flexibility to use that. So the sensor size and the resolution size were just key to getting the job done for what this director wanted.
And was that the shoot that you were here in LA for?
No. So that's another shoot that's coming up next year.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I thought you were out pretty quick. So where are we going? Well, before I do jump to that. My view on cameras is that you got to buy the right tool for the right job at the time.
Absolutely.
My rule on investing, buy glass. Investing in a camera, does that make sense anymore when you can invest? You got to have what you need to do it. Clearly, you want to stay on top of what the technology is. But in long term, the glass you bought, maybe even back to the days of House of Cards, is still going to end up on your camera from time to time, I think.
For sure. I think it's the quality of glass that you buy. So let me reference this.
Got it.
So when I first started shooting House of Cards, I was so excited because, and this is early in my career, I had gotten the Canon 16-35. And I think I spent close to like $1,800 on it, which at the time was a lot of money for me. And I was like, wow, this is so cool. And literally, I tried to sell that lens just last month and couldn't even get $300 for it. So it's impressive to see how the quality goes. But in contrast to that, so I've got a set of like Cinema Primes, the Canons that I had. I had a full set of those, and I was able to resell those for pretty much the same price that I purchased them at, which was fantastic.
Yeah, Cinema Glass tends to hold its price.
Correct. Yeah, absolutely.
In some ways, it goes up sometimes.
Absolutely. Was it the K35s from Canon?
Oh, my God.
Amazing. Everybody wants those. Want them rehoused, put them on.
I tell you, if I had a dollar for every phone call I ever got saying K35, I mean, if you think, those K35s, Canon stopped making those over 30 years ago.
Right, absolutely.
And originally a full set was about $80,000, which in, 30 years ago was a lot of money.
It's huge,
you still had that set, even in okay condition, not mint condition, you're looking at $250,000-$300,000 now.
Minimum.
Minimum. And if they're in mint condition, you can buy a house.
Yeah.
But whatever camera you bought 30 years ago, It's garage sale material. If that and whatever they recorded on, you're not going to be able to play. So, yeah, glass.
Glass is where it's at. So I think there's a market, though, for purchasing bodies and purchasing that type of equipment if you're looking at using it a lot, renting it out, and then getting rid of it within a 2 to 3 year time period. Because I think if you like look at all the folks that went out and bought Alexa Minis, Arri has really, cornered the market for the cinema cameras.
Absolutely.
I think.
Yep.
And even regardless if they don't have, 4K or above, they're still, everyone's making movies with them. So right there, like you have to pick the right cinema camera. And I think people are obviously, if you look now, you can get a cheap mini for, under 30 grand, which is incredible. But now you look at the LF that they just came out with, that's, 80,000 plus for a kit. And you can still make money on that, but you can't keep it too long. I mean, I think after 3 to 4 years, you're probably, if you haven't broken even with it, you should sell it. Just because there's going to be another camera that comes out in a 5 year time period.
But first of all, you own your own production company and you're working a lot. So you can pencil these things out. If you're a traditional doc shooter, let's say, you may shoot with that camera once, and by the time you get your next big gig, we're a whole different resolution. We're a whole different bit depth. It's no longer there. Or the network has a whole different set of requirements.
They do. Those requirements are killer, man. Netflix has pretty much set the standard for what you can have with a camera. And it's great to see that they are boasting higher resolution above other sensor types. So I think that's kind of a testament to how resolution plays in this game.
Yeah, it's a little bit controversial, but I'm a fan.
For sure.
I'm a fan of what Netflix is doing. I know it's a pain in the ass for the creatives, but it's raising the bar. And it's certainly doing that. And I mean, I 3D was never a thing for me, but resolution is. I think resolution makes a better movie. I never really was a big fan of 3D, but I was a fan of resolution. Yeah. I don't know what at what point it stops. There's 12K out on the market now. Is that a thing for you?
12K? I mean, we just finished up a project that was 16K. So, I honestly don't know where it's going. I mean, at some point, though, it's going to get to the point where you're like, well, what does it matter? Because you can only have such a big TV or such a big projection that the resolution is just going to be, non-existent. You're not going to see it. And I would say that it's coming soon. But I guess that could also be like you could then downsample that 16K file into a 4 or 8K file that could be multiple streams here and there. And just like with multi-core processors, you're going to be using more of the resolution for other things rather than just one particular shot. So it can go anywhere, I think, at this point.
Yeah. And as a manufacturer, you think in terms of engineering. Hopefully you start thinking in terms of image creation to a point. But in terms of engineering, that's what you get paid to do. What can we do better next time? But I'm still going back to glass. If I had to invest in something right now, it'd be glass.
Yeah, hands down. Glass is the way to go.
It would definitely be glass. Whatever it is, like Canon makes a spectacular piece of glass called a 50 to 1000.
Really, I know. You were actually going to let me borrow that lens one time.
Yeah, you missed the boat on that one now.
Yeah,
but if you ever get your hands on it, it's a spectacular piece of glass. I think $70,000 range. So it's pricey. But it's really pricey. I mean, it's
really
a rental item.
A little pricey,
but honestly, if you're a rental house and you're renting that out, you're going to rent that out 3 generations from now. It's not like it goes away. Like, who knows? Right. It could be the K35 of 35 years from now. So
was that a PL mount?
It was either way, but primarily PL. I don't know PL. If you asked me to back in my Canon days, if you asked me to find an EF version of it. That would be a challenge because it's not the kind of glass that necessarily gets put on on an EF style camera, but primarily PL. But you could get an EF. So that was a great little lens. All right. So the other day I happened to catch your social media post on the new Sony A7 S3, I think.
Yes.
It's the first time I've ever seen even a box in the wild. I know you haven't had a long chance to play with it. But I'm sort of in the market for a new camera these days, probably switching brands myself. So what do you think? Sell me.
So if I sell you on this camera and I don't want to overhype it, it's probably the best camera I've used, hands down. And the reason for that is just the ergonomics to it. So I'm holding the camera up right now. But I'm feeling the grip with this. Like your hand just folds into it. And it's beautiful. It now has the full touchscreen capability, so you can go on, touch anything that you want, configure it. And the live AF for video production is huge. I mean, you can set the focal speed that you want to go from, if you want it to fast or slow. It just really creates these beautiful cinematic shots. And I've been playing with that for the last day, which hasn't obviously been a lot, but I'm just blown away by just the previous generation. And then being able to crank this guy up to past 100,000 ISO is, and actually get an acceptable clear image, especially at a 4K resolution, it's insane.
How much have you done? How much testing did, I mean, I know it's a day, but did you go to 100,000 and really pixel peep it?
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the first things I did.
Yeah. Just,
I mean, so the A7S, if you're not familiar with it, is all about sensitivity. And it's about utilizing, you know, higher ISOs with smaller pixels because, or I guess to be larger pixels, but with a smaller megapixel count. And it really allows you to bring all of that information into the sensor and see it beautifully without the noise that you would traditionally get from higher resolution cameras. So that for me is a huge selling point because a lot of the stuff that I work with really deals with a lot of nighttime shooting or dusk shooting, and being able to have that ability, especially now with the 4K 10-bit internal or even the 16-bit external, that's huge. Mm-hmm. And then being able to capture that with the low light just means that you can create shots that no one's ever seen before because the camera hasn't existed. These type of specs, even on higher end production cameras, they don't exist. And I think it's kind of a testament to where Sony's come from. I mean, they're all about their sensors, and being able to have a sensor that can basically see into the night and give you a usable image, it's huge.
So one of the phrases you used on your social media was girth. The girth of this camera. And
it's
not the most technical of terms. But
it is not.
Honestly, when I pick up a camera, that's what I'm reaching for. And I never disliked the Sony, but probably because I was used to holding a different kind of camera.
Sure.
But I'm getting the sense that because of that handle, it's gonna feel much more natural in my hand. It's gonna be a lot more comfortable. Now I'm definitely looking forward to seeing that. Unfortunately, you know, it's 2020, so I don't know when that's physically gonna be.
Well, maybe I'll send you out a tester model if you want to play around with it.
Actually, I don't even need to play it. I want to hold it. You know, to me, a camera is like a pair of shoes. I can't buy that on the internet. I got to try it on because I'm going to have it in my hands for hours and days and months and maybe years. And that plays into it. I can look at the specs of a camera and sort of decide whether I like it or not.
Sure.
I mean, I still want to see an image and I still want to dig deeper, but
right.
I got to touch it. It's just not going to be an Amazon purchase for me. So,
no. And it shouldn't be. I mean, it's an investment. I mean, you're talking about putting thousands of dollars into a piece of equipment that you're going to be using for years. So you want to be able to have something that you know is going to be functional, but also feel right to you as a shooter. And I know I can say this in the past too. I really wasn't impressed with a lot of the earlier generations of the Sony cameras. I mean, they definitely felt rinky and tiny and very fragile. But after the Mark III series, they really like upped their game as far as the quality of the durability and the reliability of the bodies themselves. But now, I mean, this just feels right. I mean, your hand sinks into the shutter and it's the right width and it's got the right nice grip on it. It just feels natural to shoot with this now. So I'm really impressed with it.
Is that your vacation cam?
It's going to be my new vacation cam and all around everything else cam. So, and I think what's cool about it too, is it's perfect for photos as well. I mean, I don't know if you've seen the 4K images that come off of this. I mean, the resolution is only 12 megapixels. So you're not going to be blowing up banner sized photos from this thing, but you can print off an 8x10 or an 11x16, and it looks incredible. And that's something I'm going to be showing off, I think, later on the week, just how big the prints are, even because everyone's like, oh, it's only 12 megapixels. That's not a photo camera. And I don't think people realize the quality that comes with the sensor. It's not necessarily indicative to just the megapixel count.
So. Is this going to be one of those shoots where you have to drag your poor wife into it again?
Probably. I mean, she loves it when I use her.
Oh, she's in every shoot you've done. You know, it's a good thing you married well.
She is. Yeah. She's a good woman. She helps me out quite a bit.
And nice and patient. So.
She is.
Hey, I'm coming to DC. So that's maybe good. You can put the thing in my hands.
Yeah.
I'm 100%. My son's out there. I'm going to visit him. I haven't seen him in a year because of 2020. So my wife and I are going to roll the dice and get on an airplane. So now I have more reason to call you up.
Dude, yeah, please. Go call me up. We'll go out and have a little shooting adventure if you want.
I'll see if I can explain that to her. That I'm going to shoot on my vacation. That might work for you, but after 30 years in the business, I don't even try. All right. So I want you to do a shout out to your websites. Where can people see all this work that we talked about?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, check us out at district7.com. That's our main production website. You can check me out on Instagram at Drew Giggity, G-I-T-T-I-Y. That is a Quagmire Family Guy reference. That's true. And my YouTube channel, just do a search for District 7 Drew Geraci. And you can check out all of we've got tons of different time-lapse tutorials as well as inspirational stuff and gear review. So all over the place.
Yeah, I've been to all of those in the last two or three days getting ready for this. It's well worth your time. Go to those sites. Take a look at the work. It is truly inspirational. I love the horn stuff. Stuff that I thought you would have done. I saw a couple things on there that I'd seen in the past and didn't know was yours, but they were memorable. So anyway, Perfect. Yeah, definitely. If you're a listener, you're listening, go check it out. Let's put some visuals to what you just heard. So, all right, Drew, I think that's going to wrap it for us. So I really appreciate you coming by. I'm glad. I'm looking forward to seeing you next month. And thank you so much for doing this.
Absolutely. And thanks for having me, Tim. I appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Okay, hang on. We will be right back after this commercial. I am really sorry to see this one end. I'm a huge fan of Drew's work and could have kept this one going for another hour. Don't forget to check out Drew's work at district7.com. And if you like what you heard, please hit that subscribe button. Also, check out our past episodes of Hollywood How Did You Get Here with Tim Smith on Apple Podcasts, YouTube, Anchor, or your favorite podcast network. Any questions, ideas, or just want to chat, hit me up at The Art of the Image with Tim Smith on Facebook. So for now, stay safe, stay healthy, and we'll see you next time on Hollywood How Did You Get Here?